Good morning. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, counsel. The next case on our oral calendar this morning is LVNV Funding LLC versus Joanda Wilkes. We're hearing oral arguments this morning remotely via the Zoom platform, but our procedures are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for primary argument on behalf of his client. Appellant's attorney will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. The marshal will hold up an iPhone, which displays the time left remaining in your argument. That's as good as we get this morning, so be mindful of the time. Also, be mindful of when a judge is attempting to interrupt you to ask a question. It's more difficult in this format, but we found it does work. So thank you for appearing this morning. With that, we'll hear from counsel for appellant. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
May it please the court, Darren Schwiebert as counsel for the appellant. There are a number of issues on appeal. I want to begin with the issue of account stated and the required elements of account stated. All of the law cited by all of the parties, including the district court, agree that one of the required elements of account stated is proof by the plaintiff that the defendant retained the statement of account. This appears on paragraphs 3 and 6 of the district court's opinion, citing American Druggist and Meagher. It appears in our appellant's brief, citing Meagher and Reese Design. It even appears in respondent's briefs, citing Lambert, Lumber, and Butler. Everybody agrees that the required element is that the statements of account must have been retained in order for there to be an account stated. Keep in mind, the plaintiff had their choice as to the cause of action in this case, and they chose an account stated claim. They didn't choose a breach of contract claim or any other claim in this case. They chose to try and force the square peg of this case into the round hole of account stated. The district court's decision that there was evidence that these statements of account were retained was clearly erroneous. There was no evidence in the record that they were retained by the appellant.
Well, wasn't there evidence, Mr. Schwiebert, that payments were made on this account regularly up until and through May of 2017?
They're in the documents, if admissible, there is evidence of payments. However, the appellant testified she didn't make those payments.
Right. I understand that. I want to clear up this reference to the question of if they're admissible. Don't we have to read the district court's findings, conclusion, and order as implicitly saying this Exhibit 7 was admissible because, in fact, it relies on that, doesn't it?
The district court determined that the documents were admissible in relying on it. The district court committed error in allowing those documents to be admissible.
Right.
Because okay. They're here saying they don't satisfy.
Can I ask you this question then? So if, you know, assuming that Exhibit 7 is admitted, it is evidence that payments were made up through May 2017 on the account. Is there any evidence that your client objected to any of the account statements received before or after May of 2017?
She didn't object because she didn't receive them.
No, so, and I understand that was her testimony. And okay, thank you.
So the answer is no, there is no objection because objection wasn't possible. What the only witness called for by the plaintiff testified was that she couldn't speak to delivery. That's the transcript at page 38 when the court asks her the question about, do these documents actually show delivery? And she admits she can't speak to delivery and the documents don't talk about delivery. Then the appellant testifies that the very first time she sees these documents is in preparing for trial. She did not receive them. She did not retain them. That's the important part for the account stated. As the plaintiff admits in their briefing, mailing alone is not enough for account stated, citing Western Newspaper. The fact that they were mailed, which is the only evidence they put in the record, that allegedly these were mailed because they have the statement, if they're admissible, that's not enough. They concede that. What doesn't appear in the record is any evidence that it was actually received by the appellant or any evidence that it was retained by the appellant. And the reason, I'm sorry.
Except, of course, the implicit evidence, if you will, the fact that these accounts payments were made for years and years. I mean, that's evidence of receipt, isn't it?
Well, payment was made by someone, but payment wasn't made by my client. And maybe this is the right point to dovetail into the first issue in our appellant brief, which is Geronda Washington, who's actually my client, is not Joanda Wilkes. As a matter of fact, there was no evidence at the trial that she was the same person. There was evidence that she had the same last name at some point in time, but she affirmatively testified as to this account that she didn't open it, she didn't use it, she didn't make payment. She'd never had a credit card before. I mean, imagine the pro se defendant who gets sued and she's never had a credit card. Now, instead of defaulting, like the majority of these cases, she does the right thing. She retains an attorney, we go to conciliation court, and then it gets appealed to district court. But she didn't make the payments. She couldn't have objected because she never received the statements. What we don't know is what happened to the statements. But that's not the defendant, the appellant's burden of proof. That's their burden of proof. And whether these got thrown away by the post office or thrown away when mail came to the wrong person's name or delivered to another house or whatever, it doesn't matter because their only claim is account stated. And in order to get an account stated claim under the Minnesota Supreme Court, there's a very specific factual requirement they have to prove. And they didn't establish that factual proof. The district court erred in holding that my client was Joanda Wilkes. There was no evidence other than the fact she had the same last name that was true. I want to talk about
counsel, but there was evidence that the account was opened using her social security number, using the address that she lived at, using a phone number that she admitted was hers. I mean, that's evidence of identity of a person, isn't it?
Well, there's no evidence it was opened using that information. The only evidence is that those records currently have that information in it, along with other information that was inaccurate. And as the quote from the Attorney General, which is the start of our reply brief, explains, you know, when they cast this net to try and find these people years later, right, they try and find somebody who's got a similar name. That doesn't mean that information was part of opening the account. And again, she testifies, she doesn't open it. Whether it's identity theft, which is one of the possibilities the Attorney General identifies or not, we don't know. What we know is it's not her credit card. She's not making the payments through some entity in, I think it's Las Vegas, that's paying on the four statements, if you actually look at those exhibits. Admissibility. There's no dispute that all of the evidence introduced by the plaintiff is hearsay. They want to overcome that hearsay through the business record exception. In order to do that, two things have to happen. First, their witness has to be qualified. And their witness, they got to choose what witness they brought, was not qualified. In fact, the court held during the trial, she wasn't qualified to talk about the transfer. But she also wasn't qualified to talk about these statements. The appellee, the respondent, simply throws up National T and says it can be anyone. But that's not what National T says. In National T, the Minnesota Supreme Court allowed an engineer with experience on underwriter laboratory certification as an expert to testify about it. And then in the middle of the opinion, it provides the example of a certified public accountant who could examine the books and records and determine that they then could be qualified to testify about them. Ms. Mason is not a certified public accountant. She doesn't have the required knowledge of the system in order to testify. But then that gets us to the second half of the question, which is, did she actually provide the four required foundational elements for the business record exception? And the answer is no. And we bring this up in our brief and the respondent just skips right past it. There are four specific required elements. And this is why the In re Simon case is so applicable, because the court held that even if the witness had been qualified, they failed to provide the four required foundational elements to establish that they were business records to get around the hearsay rule. Because they failed to do that, the documents themselves are inadmissible, which means the whole case is gone.
Counsel, what is missing?
She doesn't testify that the documents were made by a person with personal knowledge on matters recorded. She doesn't testify that it was made near or at the time of the recorded event. She doesn't testify they were kept in the regular course of business activity. And she doesn't testify they were made as part of the regular practice of business activity. This is Credit One Bank. She's got to testify that Credit One Bank made these records that way. And that's for the billing statements. The transfer documents, the court says she's not qualified to testify about the transfer. So we know those documents can't come in under the business record exception because the court itself holds she's not qualified to testify as to the transfer. And if she's not qualified to testify as the transfer, she can't lay the foundation for the transfer documents. That's why the evidence is not admissible. Moving to the question of standing. It is the plaintiff's burden, and it never shifts, to show standing to bring the claim. There is no direct connection between LVNV Funding, the plaintiff, and the defendant in this case. LVNV Funding contends that they acquired the account through assignment. And as laid out in our opening brief, the evidence, even if admissible, doesn't establish that. Now, when we get to their opposition, they concede that the evidence doesn't establish it. They simply point to General Underwriters versus Klein and say, you can't challenge it. You don't have standing to challenge it. Well, we're not challenging the validity of the assignment. We don't dispute that an account can be assigned. What we're saying is, and the evidence in this case, even if all of the evidence was allowed is admissible, they haven't established that this account made it through this crazy chain and all the way to LVNV Funding. And that's their burden.
Are you arguing that a bill of sale is required in order to demonstrate, even when you're dealing with bundled accounts like this?
Well, a bill of sale identifying that the particular account is attached is one way to prove it. As to the last two steps in this chain, they don't even use a bill of sale. They use a declaration. I'm not saying that a bill of sale always has to be required. I mean, in theory, somebody who actually has knowledge of the transfer, which they didn't have, could come in and testify about the transfer. But if the problem in this thing is at one point it branches and goes two different directions at the same time. And we don't know, one of them loops back to LVNV, but the other one never does. So we don't know what happened to them. We don't know that it ever happened. The other case they cite is TEM Capital. TM Capital, of course, is an unreported case and therefore is not precedential. That's MnStat 480A08 subdivision 3C. But even if the court considers TEM Capital, in TEM Capital, while the court says we can't challenge the validity of the assignment, conscionability, consideration, those type of argument, the court actually goes on to consider the evidence and says, yes, they actually do have the evidence that this account made it to the plaintiff. That's what's missing in this case. And respondent concedes that by not opposing it when you get to the appeal. There is no evidence that it actually made it to LVNV Funding, and that's their burden to establish in order to establish standing. I understand that this case certainly doesn't have the media attention that the next oral argument that the court's gonna have has, but there are very important issues in this case. And they're important issues about what it takes for a debt buyer like this plaintiff to sue a consumer in Minnesota. And if they choose to choose accounts stated as their theory, there are evidentiary requirements. There's a consequence of that choice. They have to meet those standards. And if they choose to sue, there's a consequence of that choice. They have to establish their standing. And if they bring a witness to trial, there's a consequence. That person has to be qualified and it has to be able to establish that the evidence is actually admissible under the business record exception. Otherwise, it's inadmissible hearsay. Plaintiff in this case, the respondent, didn't satisfy their burdens. Miss Washington is not Joeyonda Wilkes. And she testified unambiguously that she had nothing to do with this. She had not even been to some of the states where these charges allegedly took place.
Mr. Schwebert, is it fair to assume the district court found her not credible?
There is no credibility determination in the district court's order.
Right, I'm asking, but can we infer that? Is that implied?
I don't think that that can be implied or inferred because he never reaches that issue. There's simply a conclusion that the evidence set X without saying I reached that conclusion by deciding that Miss Washington was not believable. I don't know how he reached the conclusion he reaches because he never explains it.
Am I correct that you did not file a motion for amended findings?
We did not. That is correct.
And so on review, on appeal, I mean, we're simply looking at the evidentiary record to see if it in some way supports the judgment, supports the conclusions of law and the judgment, irrespective of any absences in the reasoning. Is that fair?
I do understand that the burden is on us to show it's clearly erroneous. But even without my client's testimony, they haven't met their evidentiary burden, meaning they have to prove standing.
But I guess, I mean, I think maybe here the conversation should turn to the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. I mean, it seems to me that they may not have nailed that down as firmly as you'd like, but wasn't there evidence in the record that allows the district court to disbelieve the defendant and to make inferences about what, by preponderance of the evidence, what likely happened? Isn't that kind of the ultimate question?
I understand the question. The answer is no. There was no evidence in the record from which the court could have determined, through a credibility assessment, that she retained the document. There was no evidence in the record through which the court could determine that the account was transferred to NV Funding. There was no evidence in the record that would have established that they met their evidentiary burden. There is positive evidence on our side, but even if the Court of Appeals ignores the positive evidence, their evidence, their burden of proof was never satisfied by them.
And that statement that you just made, is that necessarily dependent on your admissibility argument? Or let's assume for the moment that we rule against you by saying that all of the documents were properly admitted. Then is there evidence to support the judgment?
No. There still is not evidence that it was retained, and there's still no evidence that it was, even in their own documents, that it was transferred to LVNV Funding. They abandoned that argument.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument if you choose to use it. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Would you please introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael Arthur, counsel for respondent LVNV Funding. In this case, I suppose I'll mirror counsel Schwiebert's order of how he handled this, and we can start with the account stated. Counsel is correct that retention is one of the necessary qualifiers, but we would argue that retention is shown by the failure to object. In this case, Ms. Mason testified that these billing statements, which all bore Ms. Wilkes' address, Ms. Washington's address, were sent there over a period of about 7 years. And as the court has already established here, payments were made on this account and there were no objections. According to the testimony of Ms. Mason, had any of these Credit One billing statements not made it to the address, had been returned as undeliverable, the account would have immediately been held in escrow until the account holder could have been found. That testimony was unchallenged. There was no evidence put forward that at any point the account was held in escrow, leading the court, obviously, with a preponderance standard to infer that these billing statements were making it to Ms. Washington.
And I think, Mr. Arthur, that assumes, I mean, was the evidence that if a mailing had been returned to the sender?
That is correct. If the mailing had come back as a bad address, again, this was 7 years worth of billing statements to this Cook Avenue address. Had the address been returned as undeliverable, it would have been held in escrow. There was, in terms of who the identity of the defendant is here, as the court pointed out, we do have a matching Social Security number. We have an address that was used for the billing statements over a period of 7 years. We do have the matching maiden name and the phone number as well. In terms of account stated, you know, these are all arriving addressed to Ms. Wilkes under her maiden name. Under appellant standard, it would seem that to prove retention, a credit card company would almost need to send statements certified or with a signature. At this point, you know, the retention is shown by the failure to object. Now, again, this testimony is all established by Ms. Mason. The appellants believe that Ms. Mason was not qualified to testify on any of these issues. Ms. Mason testified that she was and is a custodian of records for LVNB funding, an employee of Resurgent Capital Services, which acts as the custodian for LVNB. And she's been.
How does that, and I understand that's her testimony, and I understand she expressed that she works with these bundled accounts every day, but how does that put her in a position to trace back the chain of transfer all the way back to Credit One? That's the problem I'm having with your argument. I mean, I think there is, how is she qualified to take, to establish every link in that chain?
She's qualified to do that because she's been trained by Credit One and she acts for LVNV funding. So she can trace from the beginning due to her training in Credit One and how this process works all the way to LVNV funding. In terms of her qualifications, we would argue that, again, this is not there's no minimum qualification needed under National T. It's simply a showing that you understand the system of the parties involved within the documentation. So in this case, she did testify about her training with Credit One and followed the transfer through. And there's a great deal of testimony where she talks about the splitting of the account, how between MHC and FMBM, we're talking about accounts receivables and accounts payable and how they loop back to LVNB funding. I think it's several pages in the transcript of tracing this transfer from the beginning to the end where LVNB funding is come forward. And we would argue too, in terms of assignment, that the appellants are misreading Klein, that Klein does say that unless there is a challenge between the creditors, there's competing claims to the debt, that the assignment itself is unchallengeable. Appellants seem to be threading a needle here where they're saying they're not challenging the validity of the assignment, they're simply challenging the assignment. Yes, Judge Johnson, were you hopping on?
No, I had unmuted because I mean, to me, the issue is, did your client prove that it was the owner slash holder of these accounts? And I don't know that that's a challenge to the validity of any transfers, but has your client made that showing? Because absent proof that you are the owner of the account, you don't have any right of recovery.
Certainly, I would argue that Ms. Mason's testimony showed that it was enough to authenticate the transfer documents, which showed the minimum requirement, which is a manifest intent to transfer. The appellant seemed to be reading a bill of sale or a declaration or some sort of specific documentation is necessary. In this case, the documents as authenticated by Ms. Mason and discussed in her testimony, which I believe more than showed her knowledge of how the transfer worked, shows that this transfer, there was an intent to transfer by Credit One through its servicers to LVNB funding through its servicers to allow LVNB funding to collect the debt. And there's no evidence that's been brought forward to show that there's some competing claim to this debt.
So do I understand that, and I'm going to speak generally, whether it was specifics, but it was transferred at one point, one transferor transferred it to two different companies. And one of those recipients transferred it further eventually to your client, but the other transferee did not. So in other words, that one's, you know, maybe a dead end, so to speak. It seems like, you know, how do we know which of those transfers was valid? Is it possible both were valid? If so, then, well, I don't know. I mean, it leads me that to the, you know, maybe a judge could infer that we don't know whether the right was transferred eventually to your client or whether it was transferred to somebody else who then held on to it. And perhaps it's 50-50, and that's not a preponderance. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond in two ways. First is in terms of the assignment itself. I believe Ms. Mason testifies differently than the way the appellants put it. The way that the account splits, because Credit One uses MHC and FMBM for two different purposes, it wants to make sure that title of the account is completely transferred. I feel it's an unduly complicated assignment, but it goes through both entities and does link back up, going to Sherman Originator 3. So I would argue that there is no sort of untransferred tail of the account left in Capital One and Credit One or with its servicers. Both do make it to Sherman Originator 3, then to Sherman Originator, and then to LVNB Funding. I would argue too that the hypothetical that even if there was some residual tail left with Credit One, I believe that the under Klein, unless there is a proactive or sort of shown by the evidence competing claim to the debt, then the assignment itself is unchallengeable. But again, I would argue that Ms. Mason's testimony links the accounts back up. Looking at the documentation, they do eventually meet in Sherman Originator 3. It's an unduly complicated assignment, but they do link back up. And I would, again, go back. One point I do want to reiterate is back to National T and the standard of what Ms. Mason is able to testify about. The appellants do talk about Inri Simon. And as we note in our brief, the difference here is that in Inri Simon, of course, there's no training, there's no understanding on behalf of the witness, because in there, a social worker is trying to introduce letters compiled by a child's therapist. He has no way to testify whether these were created contemporaneously with meeting with this child, how the documentation was compiled. In this case, Ms. Mason, as I stated, did train at Capital One, Credit One, and testified that all of the documentation that Credit One would create and the transfer documents are part of contemporaneous automated systems, which would imply that these are created in the necessary course of business and at the time that these records are incurred. And all of this is automatically, electronically transferred through the chain, and these documents, the billing statements themselves, are automatically created as part of this process and sent on to, in this case, the Cook Avenue address belonging to Ms. Washington. And so with that, I can yield back and give back the time to the court unless there are further questions.
Thank you for your argument. If there are no additional questions, we'll hear rebuttal argument from appellant's counsel at this point.
The evidentiary burden for accounts stated is not that there has to be an objection. It's that they have to retain it without objection for an unreasonable amount of time. It's that retained element that they keep jumping over. And they say, well, because she failed to object, she must have retained it. I don't think those two things are even close to the same. We don't know what happened to these letters that were allegedly put in the mail. That evidence is never put into the record. But if they were delivered to someone who throws them all away, account stated cannot apply. That's what the law says. It has to be retained for an unreasonable amount of time in order for the round hole of account stated, that claim they chose to bring, to apply.
And again, it brings me back to the fact that these statements were paid for years and years and years, up to through May of 2017.
My best guess is identity theft, but I'm speculating because there's no evidence in the record as to who that is or why that is. But even if there are payments, that doesn't mean that the statements were retained. But now we're really starting to speculate as to what happened. All we know is, had they asked, and they served no discovery, Ms. Washington before the trial to produce the record she had none, except for the ones they produced to her as trial exhibits. And that's the first time that she sees them. So she did not retain them because she did not receive them. What happened to them? That's not our burden of proof. That's their burden of proof. Respondent relies very heavily in his argument on Ms. Mason testifying about the transfer. The problem with that is the court on page 55 of the transcript specifically held this witness is not qualified to talk about the actual transfer. That's the mic drop moment, right? If she's not qualified to talk about the transfer, they can't get it in through her testimony. And they can't get it in through the records because she's not qualified to lay the foundation for the records. That's their burden.
Does a person who can testify under the business record exception have to have created the record about which they've been asked to testify?
No. but they have to be qualified. They have to be sufficiently qualified, which is what National T says. And the example for business records like this that the Supreme Court gave was a certified public accountant. Instead, we have somebody who works for a sister company of LVNV, who's trying to testify about something that happened at Bank One at every chain along the way, even though she has no knowledge or involvement in any of that. That's never in the record. There's a lot of discussion in respondents' comment about her training, but she testified that all her training existed of were some statements made by Credit One and looking at some documents. That's in the transcript on page 27 at pages line 20 to 28, line 19. In fact, she admits that she's never even accessed their computer system. She doesn't know how it works. She's not qualified to testify about either the transfer documents, the court held that, and she's got no qualification on that, or the statements of account. Klein, there is something more than we want this to have happened, which counsel refers to as a manifest of intent, that's required for them to establish standing. And their chain does have a split and does have a dead end, and they don't contest that in their responsive brief. We spent a long time laying out this complicated chain. And they have to prove their standing. That's their burden to prove the standing. The only witness they had, the court held, was not qualified. And the documents themselves, which they abandon, don't meet it. They can't simply say underwriter general, you can't challenge it. What we're challenging is not the conscionability or the consideration of the assignment. These are assignable. The question is, did you assign this account? Do you have standing? Are you the right plaintiff? There does not need to be a competing challenge in order for them not to have standing. That's a false scarecrow created by the respondent. Their burden is to prove they own it, so they can be the one who brings the lawsuit. And they don't do that in this case. The Minnesota Attorney General says it's not uncommon for this to happen. They got the wrong defendant. She testified. It's not her. Thank you.
Thank you to the attorneys for your briefing and your arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute.